Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a retired Army colonel and State Department diplomat turned peace activist. Colonel Ann Wright served in the U.S. Army for a total of 29 years in a combination of active duty and in the Army Reserve before joining the State Department in 1987. There she served as a deputy chief of mission at U.S. embassies in Afghanistan, which she helped reopen after the defeat of the Taliban, Mongolia, Micronesia, and Sierra Leone, where she received the State Department Medal for Heroism for helping evacuate several thousand people during the Civil War there. But in March 2003, Wright resigned on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, one of three State Department officials to publicly resign in protest of the war. Since that time, she's been a voice of dissent against the war in Iraq and elsewhere. She's co-authored a book titled Dissent, Voices of Conscience, protested with anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan, been arrested in anti-war demonstrations, and was an observer of the Gaza flotilla, which tried to break the Israeli embargo on that Palestinian enclave. Colonel Ann Wright will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in the lecture hall of Chapman Hall on the TU campus, offering perspectives on the American military interventions. I spoke with her yesterday by phone, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Colonel Wright, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I want to start with the day's recent events in the last few weeks where the president threatened to bomb Syria in reaction to the use of chemical weapons there, and it looks like we might have a diplomatic solution. What was your reaction to that?
Well, as a former military or retired military, 29 years in the Army, and then 16 years as a U.S. diplomat, and having resigned in 2003, 10 years ago, in opposition to a war, I was very, very concerned about the president's threat of, and it seemed to be an imminent threat, of using military might to, well, we couldn't quite figure out what, to resolve the issue of chemical weapons. Were they going to try to destroy the chemical weapons areas? Were they going to take out the Syrian Air Force? Nobody knew what the U.S. was planning on this, and there was a lot of question about what the evidence really was, about who caused the deaths of a questionable number of Syrian citizens, ranging anywhere from 350 by some accounts all the way up to the administration's count of 1,426. And, of course, that's really three times more than what any other organization had counted. So I, as a longtime U.S. government employee, working both in the Department of Defense and the State Department, I was really concerned that the president was getting us out on another one of these limbs, like George Bush did on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that the evidence was not there. And even if the evidence is there, what really should be the response? Do you kill more people to go after the people who have killed lots of people? I was hoping that maybe we could get past that type of philosophy in this day and time.
What should be the reaction, though? Because I think even those who feel like, no, not a yet another adventure in the Middle East, there's something about the use of a weapon of mass destruction like chemical weapons that says we have to do something.
I agree. I mean, I like everybody else, am horrified that whatever number of Syrian citizens it is, that those people died by the use of chemical weapons. It's horrific. And definitely there should be punishment accorded to those who use those chemical weapons. The jury still, in my opinion, is out. Even though the United Nations has done an extensive survey of the areas that were, or not all the areas, but the primary areas where people died of chemical inhalation. But there's still some, even though the president just today was talking at the United Nations about it's indisputable who is behind that, there still is some question within the retired members of our U.S. intelligence community, with whom I am in constant contact, about really who used those weapons. So I totally agree that somebody needs to stand accountable for that, but gosh, you need to make sure you've got the right people. And I think the original threat of an imminent threat of the use of military action, that the president wisely pulled back from that. And We're not too sure why he did it. It may be that there was some more information that came to him that said that there are other things that are now coming to light, that the original assessment of some members of the intelligence community. You know, the assessment that was put out by the Obama administration is not called an intelligence assessment, which is the name of the official assessment by the intelligence community. If it is something that's done by the 17 agencies, intelligence agencies of the United States, it's called specifically an intelligence assessment. But this one was very pointedly called a government assessment, which is not the solid view of the intelligence community. So there, in my opinion, is there is still some concern about not knowing specifically who did this.
Hmm. Well, given the fact that there seems to be a diplomatic solution in Assad giving up control of his chemical weapons, is this a good development in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. And one can certainly argue that the threat of military action did move the Russian government to start working with the Syrian government to move toward diplomatic resolution of this. And for that, I am eternally grateful. It is very important that all nations give up their chemical weapons, to include the United States. You know, even though we're a signatory to the ban on chemical weapons, and we have destroyed probably 90% of ours, we still have 10%. We've got thousands of tons of chemical weapons that still have not been destroyed by the United States.
Mm. Well, let me ask you, you're going to be speaking on some of the things we might have learned as a country after the last decade of intervention in Afghanistan and Iraq. What do you think the lessons learned have been, and have we learned them?
Well, one of the lessons is to really challenge our government when they start coming up with other military operations and the rationale for them. And I think the American public standing up to say to the Obama administration, wait a minute, we're not buying this thing that the United States unilaterally has to be the world policeman and attack a country that the administration is alleging that used these chemical weapons. The American public just said no, and it came through Congress loud and clear, and I think that's a very good thing. Having been in our U.S. government for 35 years in both the military and the State Department, I say always challenge what your government's telling you. It's not that it's always lying to you by any means, but there are times when the government just doesn't put out all the information. And through WikiLeaks, we have learned so much about what our government has been doing with other countries. And I think most Americans who have read through those WikiLeaks documents have been stunned, as have citizens in countries throughout the world, about what goes on behind the scenes. And it's not all things that we should be proud of. So one of the lessons that I think the American public has learned, as demonstrated by what happened on this Syria thing, is that you have to push back. When you feel the United States should not get involved in a military operation, the people need to say so, which they did loud and clear.
What about the two interventions themselves, Afghanistan and Iraq? Of course, as we know, you resigned from the State Department the day before the invasion of Iraq over that decision. What about Afghanistan? I mean, in 2001, after the bombings in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, obviously this was considered a just action at that particular point. What went wrong, and what should we learn from that?
Well, I actually went to Afghanistan in December of 2001. I was on the very small team that reopened the U.S. embassy that had been closed for 12 years. So I was there in the very early days, where we had some hope that al-Qaeda could be done away with for what they had done, and that the hold of the Taliban over the last, at that time, 5 years over Afghanistan and its very brutal and violent repression of the Afghan people could be broken, and that there was an opportunity, a small window of opportunity, as we well knew, because the Afghan people have a history of, no matter what the rationale for foreign international intervention, you better not stay long, because the Afghan people will get rid of you no matter what. And we're seeing that right now. The United States has been in Afghanistan for 12 years. We've spent $1 trillion at least in Afghanistan, and well over $3.5 trillion, and some estimates may go up to $5 trillion on the two wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. Our supposition in the early days in Afghanistan that you had about, you know, maybe 2-3 years to try to get a lot of things done with the new interim government of Afghanistan to help the government build lots of schools, build health clinics, roads, try to help in a small way to counter what the Taliban had done, and then get out. That did not happen because of the Bush administration's decision to really refocus. Mere days after the intervention in Afghanistan, the plans for the invasion and occupation of Iraq were already starting, and none of the resources, human resources or financial resources, that should have gone into Afghanistan went in there in the first really 5 years, 6 years. So the window of opportunity closed, and the strength of the Taliban emerged, increased, and as you see now, the stalemate in terms of the largest military in the world, the United States, in cooperation with the International Security Assistance Force that has numbered some 40 countries at various times, and that has had well over 150,000 Americans, and then you count in the ISAF forces, it'll bring it up to about 200,000, plus Afghan security that we have trained will bring it up to about 500,000 between the Afghan National Police and the Afghan military. And it is being held at bay by what an estimate by our own CIA of no more than 15,000 Taliban. So the window of opportunity closed. The United States, I think, as much as I think it is a textbook case of spending lots of money, it going to a lot of American companies and a lot of Afghan government officials and very ingenious business entrepreneurs who were able to set up businesses to help with the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan and become extremely rich. And yet you leave the country in a very precarious condition. So,
do you think we leave it better than we found it, or about the same?
Well, I would say about the same. Well, maybe at the same as before the Taliban. The Taliban really brought it down to its knees and closed so many schools and health clinics, and it was so repressive. But prior to, well, maybe you have to go all the way back to prior to the Soviet invasion. the Afghan people.
So maybe somewhat better, but not the way we should be leaving it, perhaps.
No,
that's
not
the,
at all.
Yeah. My guest today is Ann Wright. Today she's a peace activist, and she's a former United States Army colonel, a retired U.S. State Department official. She resigned from the State Department in opposition to the Iraq War in 2003. But let me just say, she also won the State Department Award for Heroism in 1997 after helping evacuate several thousand people during the Civil War in Sierra Leone, where she closed the embassy, later then helped reopen it again. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in the Chapman Hall Lecture Hall on perspectives on an American military intervention. If I could you take us back to 2003? You were, you know, as a military officer reaching, you know, the high rank of colonel and later as a diplomat, you are a person who's worked inside the system. How difficult was it to submit your resignation and go outside of the system in 2003 as the invasion of Iraq seemed imminent?
Well, it was difficult because all of my adult life I had been essentially a government employee. There had been some breaks in it here and there, but essentially my careers had been in both the military and the diplomatic corps. And it was through 8 different presidential administrations that I had worked for the U.S. government, starting with the Johnson administration during the Vietnam War. That's when I joined the military. And then all the way through to the Bush 2 administration. So I had held my nose, as many government employees do, to various policies that each administration has. I mean, we've had some pretty crazy policies under virtually every administration, but if you've decided to make a career out of the government, you learn to hold your nose, do what you can to right the boat to the way that you think it should be, and then move over and go and work on a policy that you can really feel like you're doing something and that doesn't compromise your own conscience. And so here it was, the pending war, invasion and occupation of Iraq, which I just felt was going to be horrific for certainly the people of Iraq. Anytime the U.S. goes in, no matter what Donald Rumsfeld says and Colin Powell about, oh, it'll just be a little invasion, a little occupation, people, there won't be many people that'll get killed and not much damage. Well, anybody that's been around our military knows that that's not right. There's going to be a lot of people killed. And
now,
the plans are to destroy as much infrastructure as you can.
One of your assignments was to develop contingency plans for invading several countries. Is that true? One of which was Iraq?
Yes. I was, back in the 80s, I was assigned to the Special Operations Center in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And one of the things that we did, and the military, of course, still does, create contingency operations for potential conflict or situations throughout the world. They have plans that are on the shelf that you can just pull them off, and then you adapt them quickly to whatever the reality is for that month. And these things are updated almost annually. So I had worked on one for the Middle East and one on Iraq. My part of it was, at the time, I was part of the Civic Action, Civil Affairs, Psychological Operations crew out of Fort Bragg. And so we were doing the what would be the effect on businesses, on infrastructure, on cultural stuff. So we had a whole annex saying where these things were, where cultural things were, where protected, internationally protected monuments were, things that should be protected by U.S. forces in military operations. So I knew the level of possible military intervention, and it would be big. I mean, even though Donald Rumsfeld said, we're not going to do a big operation like we did in Gulf War I, this is going to be much more modest. And in fact, it was. They didn't send in 500,000 people into Kuwait. They sent, at the beginning, less than 150,000 people. However, they disregarded much of the military plans, which identify the obligations of military occupying forces on the protection of civilians and protection of cultural artifacts.
And of course, those were looted.
And they were looted because Donald Rumsfeld said, nope, we're not going to put guards on the Baghdad National Library that holds some of the ancient documents of the world. We're going to put on the Gardens of Babylon, we'll just put a military base right on the remains of that. I mean, it was incredible what they were doing. Although I resigned right before the shock and awe started. Before I resigned, though, about a month before, I'd sent in through what's called the dissent channel, which is a mechanism within the State Department that if you feel so strongly about an issue and you feel that if you send it up through the regular chain of command, it will get diluted by people who don't agree with you, you have this opportunity to go totally around the system. And here I was, little Ann Wright. I was a deputy ambassador for the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia at that point. And it went from my desk straight to the desk of Colin Powell. And they say that, you know, if you use the dissent channel, it's no retribution, no retaliation, but you know that's not true.
Yeah.
That somebody will find out. I mean, somebody's got to answer the letter, my concerns from Colin Powell. And from Colin Powell's perspective, and so the system gets to know who the dissenters are because they have to answer these things. And so I laid out my rationale, which is essentially what I used in my letter of resignation that came 2 weeks later, because the response I got back from Colin Powell and the State Department did not do anything to ease my mind about what the U.S. was going to do and the probable, in my opinion, the probable disastrous consequences for U.S. For the United States security, national security, because what we were going to do was going to have such negative consequences for our image and our ability to operate in the international community. And I think that was true. As it's turned out, the United States image is in very low esteem throughout the world because of our intervention in Iraq, because of what's happened in Afghanistan, because of Guantanamo and putting over 800 people there, most of whom were sold to the United States, and the use of extraordinary rendition, the torture that's gone on as an official policy of the United States, now renounced by the Obama administration. But the world has been aghast at what the United States did and continues to be very concerned with the use of assassin drones, the NSA revelations that not only are we spying on virtually everybody in the world, it also includes us American citizens down to our last email that you and I exchanged.
Well, I want to ask you one other question that has to do with, you started your military career in Vietnam, and I'm sure you saw what happened to the institutions in the military as well as, you know, other governmental institution in the wake of Vietnam. What do you expect the fallout, you know, as we're moving out of Iraq, we moved out of Iraq for the most part, we're moving out of Afghanistan. Hopefully we don't get put into another Middle Eastern country here soon, whether it be Syria or Iran somewhere down the road. I mean, things at least at this point look a little hopeful. What do you expect the long-term fallout for this decade-long, these interventions are going to be on the military? What do you expect the effects will be?
Well, we've already seen the tragic effects, just as after the Vietnam War, that so many, you know, millions of young men and women who came back from the Vietnam War as people who come back from any war, as broken souls, really, with post-traumatic stress, with now we call it traumatic brain injury, with alcoholism, drug abuse, with suicides. It's the same thing that we're seeing now after numerous deployments for these men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in fact, you can see, I think, part of the reaction that of the American public on this potential military attack on Syria was because people of America now recognize that while their politicians don't seem to care what happens to the military in terms of before they make the decision, and recognizing what the effects are going to be on over 2 million Americans by getting us involved in military operations, the American public certainly does, because they're living with these young men and women and older men and women who have come back from serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the lack of really good treatment, although I think the Veterans Administration has tried on one level, although if you're going to go into these things, one of the first things ought to be that you buck up all the facilities of the Veterans Administration, because you know what's going to be coming back. It's going to be a lot of broken souls.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, one of the things I think that came out of Vietnam is we said we learned our lessons in how to treat our returning soldiers and military personnel, but I'm not sure if we've learned the lesson or we're just overwhelmed by the numbers.
Well, we're overwhelmed by the numbers, but we shouldn't be. I mean, when you, a part of military planning is that you know the numbers of your people you're sending in. You know it down to the specific number, 150,321 people, I mean, something like that. The military can tell you exactly how many people went in, and so hopefully all of them are coming out, although there have been 4,000 dead in Iraq and I think 2,500 in Afghanistan. But you know the returning living, sometimes living dead, you know who's going to be coming back. And if you don't plan for that as you're making the operational plans to invade and occupy a country, then I think you're being very disingenuous to our military veterans and to the country as a whole, that these costs need to be calculated into a military operation. The number of suicides that we have, which is extraordinary, because people cannot cope with what they've done. And that's just on the military side. The other part of it, which we in the Midwest should really recognize, because we've had a lot of civilian contractors that hire on with Halliburton, KBR, DynCorp, and get paid big bucks to go over to Iraq and Afghanistan. And in fact, right now we've got more U.S. contractors, civilian contractors in Afghanistan than we have U.S. military. But these men and women, when they come back, those companies generally cut off their health benefits when they arrive back in the United States. So we've got contractors who have been blown up by the same IEDs that have injured our U.S. military. They have post-traumatic stress. They've got traumatic brain injuries. They've got the same alcohol problems, drug problems, and they are committing suicide too. And yet nobody's taking care of them. When we've privatized military functions, which we have done to about 50% of our military functions are now done by civilians, then you've got to calculate that into it. And that is a huge cost that nobody really has gotten the handle on how on the financial side of that.
Sounds like a lesson yet to be learned.
Yes.
Well, we look forward to your talk tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in the lecture hall of Chapman Hall. Colonel Ann Wright will be speaking on perspectives on American military intervention by a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. diplomat. I'm sure the talk will be more informal than that title. And
we'll cover a lot of ground on it.
Yeah. What's keeping you active today? You know, you were very much active and vocal against the war in Iraq. You've been involved in some of the Gaza flotillas in the Middle East. What has your attention at this particular point?
Well, I have been doing a lot of work on this issue of assassin drones, where the United States is extrajudicially killing people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Mali. So I've traveled to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen within the last year and meeting with families of victims of drone strikes and also family members of people who are still in Guantanamo, prisoners in Guantanamo, who have been cleared for release. You know, 84 out of the 164 people that are left in Guantanamo were cleared for release years ago by the U.S. government, but they've not been released. And the families in all of those countries are, you know, it's good to go talk to them, to find out who they are, what's going to happen if these men return, and to meet some of the men who have returned and who have not taken up arms against the United States miraculously. I mean, if I had been put in jail for 11 years and treated the way that they have and been one of the ones that had done nothing to the United States, that had essentially been sold by somebody to the U.S., and the U.S. couldn't figure this out, that they had been sold and had nothing to do with it, and then finally they did figure it out, cleared them, and then won't release them. It's a real miracle that there is not even more animosity toward the United States than there is already.
Well, that's an important mission. Ann Wright, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. A real pleasure.
Retired U.S. Army Colonel, former U.S. diplomat, and peace activist Ann Wright speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in the Chapman Hall Lecture Hall. The lecture is free to the public, but be advised that due to the University of Tulsa Iowa State football game, parking will be limited. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.